It is true that chronologically I got to know what my problem is and then work on it. But psychologically, I need to be convinced of my capacity of change before I engage in my deficits. Because if I start with my deficits, I might be filled with depression and despair and hopelessness.
A very good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and a very warm welcome once again to the Living Inspired series. I'd like to begin by dedicating this shiur in the memory of Zvi Schmidt, Reb Zvi Yehuda ben Ephraim Zichrono Tzadik Livracha. We just commemorated his first yahrzeit, someone who is a tremendous Eved Hashem, not only in action, but also in how he acted. A tremendous Baal Chesed, a tremendous Baal Tzedakah, but also in a most private way, and as such, with tremendous, tremendous humility. His neshama should have an aliyah, and we wish the family continued nechama, and please God, we should all only share in simchas. Before I introduce Rabbi Yitzhak Bratovitz, I'd like to take the opportunity to say a very big thank you to each and every single one of you. It is really heartwarming to see a tremendous dedication and commitment by so many hundreds of people on a weekly basis coming online to learn Torah. It's really something very special and a big shukrach to each and every single one of you. I also want to take the opportunity to say a very big thank you to my dear brother Moshe and Jonimo Event Tech for their tremendous dedication and commitment and facilitation of these webinars in a most professional form and fashion. It is greatly, greatly appreciated. Lastly, before I introduce the rabbi on this, the finale for this term of Living Inspired, and it's important to mention as well, we will be back next term with a very exciting program, and Rabbi Ken Spiro is on this coming Monday night. I'd like to take the opportunity, though, both personally and on behalf of the entire base community, to say a very big thank you to Rabbi Mofson and to the Arch. It's really been a most wonderful, wonderful partnership, a most wonderful, wonderful relationship that has borne so many fruits. And there is no question in my mind that it is just the beginning. Michael El Chayil, from strength to strength, Rabbi Mofson, please God, with much brocha and atzlocha, we really appreciate all that you do. Without further ado, Rabbi Yitzchok Bratovitz of Or Sameach Yerushalayim.
Thank you very much, and it's a real pleasure to be able to address you, and a tremendous Yasher Koach, congratulations to Rabbi Mofson, for really his legendary work over many, many years, and this is just another example of the fantastic, amazing work that he does in Johannesburg, and again, Rabbi Zolberg, for all of his help as well, and Baruch Hashem, you've assembled a great, great team of rabbis and teachers and professionals who are able to put together these types of programs, even in times of relative crisis, as we have been going through in this year of the pandemic. Pesach is approaching, of course, as everybody knows, and all of us know that the Seder of Pesach is one of the great highlights of Jewish life. Even Jews who are very far removed from tradition want to have a Pesach Seder. They want to recount the story of the Exodus of Egypt. It somehow pulls at their heartstrings. It brings to the forefront, from the recesses of almost the subconscious, the vestigial memory, some desire to connect. to the historical destiny of the Jewish people and the message of God that the freedom of Passover suggests. So I want to talk a little bit in a much more general way. I'm not going to go over the Haggadah step by step. Time is not going to allow that. But I want to share some perspectives about the Passover holiday and about the Exodus of Egypt and what type of lessons it carries for us. If we simply divide the Seder of Pesach night into its various components, I want to identify four ideas and show how they connect to each other. Idea number one is there's a tremendous emphasis on what we call She'ila u'tshuva. The Passover story cannot simply be recounted. It must be told through a process of question and answer. That is why we have the Manishtana, the four questions. And indeed, the notion of question and answer is so important that even if you're having a Seder by yourself and nobody is asking you the questions, you have to ask questions. Manishtana. I remember even as a child, I thought it was very funny. Our family was celebrating a Seder with another family, and the children in the other family were asking their father many, many questions. And father was impatient because he said to his kids, stop asking questions. We have to run the Seder. But that's kind of missing the point. The whole point of the Seder is to ask questions and then discuss various answers. I'll come back to why that's important, but I first want to identify the elements. So element number one that we're going to be discussing is the focus on question and answer. Element number two that we see in the Haggadah is that it is not enough just to start with the good part of the story. You can't just say God took us out of Egypt and we had great wealth. You have to begin with degradation. You have to begin with the slavery, the oppression, the humiliation, the beatings, the genocides. If you simply talk about the good and don't talk about the bad, the difficult, the adverse, you have not fulfilled your mitzvah. So that is the second element, which I will come back to. The third element is the well-known statement of Rabbi Gamliel. It's taken from the Mishnah, but it's in the Haggadah, that in order to fulfill the mitzvah of the Haggadah, you must explain the Pesach, the Paschal offering, the matzah, the eating of the matzah, and the bitter herbs. Meaning, even if you told the whole story, if you didn't connect that story to Pesach, matzah, maror, you were not yotzei your mitzvah. And again, we will come back to that. And the fourth element is a statement that also appears in the Haggadah that is taken from the Mishnah. And that is, each person must regard themselves as if they themselves were liberated from Egypt. It is not enough to commemorate. It is not enough to remember. It is not enough to simply recount an event that happened in the past. But the Haggadah makes an extraordinary demand upon us that we literally are supposed to re-experience the idea that we ourselves are being liberated from Egypt. So, Bekitzor, in brief, there are four elements of the Seder that I want to address. Number one, the imperative of question and answer. Number two, the obligation to begin with the bad and then proceed to the good. Number three, the duty to link the story of the Exodus with the eating of the Paschal offering, the matzah and the maror. And finally, number four, the idea that one has to experience being liberated from Mitzrayim and not simply commemorate and remember. And what I'm going to attempting to do tonight is to show how all of these four elements are interrelated and carry a very powerful message for us this Pesach, really the entire year. And I'm going to start in reverse order. I want to start with element number four, because element number four will be the key to understanding all the other elements as well. Element four, Each person must regard themselves as if they themselves were liberated from Egypt. In what sense is that meaningful? I was never in Egypt, and even those of you that may have traveled to Egypt were certainly not slaves in Egypt. What is the point of feeling as if I was a slave that was liberated from Egypt, if in fact that is not true? Are we simply playing a make-believe game? Now, don't confuse this with an earlier statement in the Haggadah. The Haggadah earlier states that if God wouldn't have taken our forefathers out of Egypt, we might still have disappeared, we might have been slaves, etc. That's making the point that I am grateful for what God did to my ancestors because that benefits me. Okay, that much is true. But that's not the same thing as saying I myself was redeemed from slavery. So in what sense is that even a meaningful idea? So I'm going to give you two answers. One is a simple answer of the Rambam, and the other is a bit of a more complex answer from the Baal Tanya, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Alter Rebbe, of Shneur Zalman of Liadin. The Rambam basically says that the notion is to simply harness the power of imagination. It's very difficult for me, at a vantage point of 3,000 years, to be grateful to Hashem for taking me out of Mitzrayim. So how do I generate within my personality the gratitude that I need in order to be makir tov, in order to express gratitude to HaKadosh Baruch Hu? The answer is, I have to imagine what life would have been like had I been a slave. I have to imagine the beatings, the servitude, the humiliation, the degradation, the sense of despair. It's kind of like method acting. And by experiencing the slavery on an emotional level, that can generate within my personality a depth of gratitude for the freedom that God has given me. So according to the Rambam, it is a make-believe game, but it is a make-believe for a very constructive purpose, that in order to appreciate what Hashem has done for us, I have to put myself in that situation, even though, in factual truth, that was never the situation I was actually in. That is the Rambam, and I call it maybe a bit irreverently the method acting approach, in which you put yourself in the experience by the creative use of your imagination. That is the approach of the Rambam. But there's an alternative approach that I find especially powerful from the author of the Tanya, the Baal HaTanya. And he says the following: maybe there's an alternative translation to the word Mitzrayim. Again, the Hebrew phrase is very significant. Each person must regard themselves as if they were taken out of Mitzrayim. Every Haggadah will translate Mitzrayim as Egypt. We were taken out of Egypt. But the Baal HaTanya suggests that there may be an alternative translation here. The word Mitzrayim indeed means Egypt, an ancient empire that was very, very powerful, that enslaved our people. But Mitzrayim also comes from the word Meitzar. Meitzar is boundary, constriction, something that is blocking you. Like King David says in the Hallel, Min ha-Meitzar karasika, I call out to God from the narrow, confining straits, and I ask God to redeem me. Seen in that way, says the Baal HaTanya, every person has their own inner Mitzrayim. Every person has blockages, boundaries, and constrictions that prevent them from reaching God. My Mitzrayim might be egotism, it might be arrogance, it might be conceit, it might be selfishness, it may be laziness, it may be a lack of self-esteem and depression. It may be anger and resentment. All of these things block me, they cement me, they prevent me from moving forward. They are my inner Mitzrayims. And as the saying goes, it is easier to take the Jew out of Mitzrayim than it is to take Mitzrayim out of the Jew. Slavery can take many, many forms. There is the slavery of the taskmaster with the whip. And then there's the slavery to my Yetzer Hara, to my own evil inclination, to the demons, so to speak, within me that lead me astray and prevent me from realizing the God-given potential that the Almighty has endowed me with because of my divine soul. And says the Baal HaTanya, when God took the Jews out of Mitzrayim, i.e. Egypt, he put into the world a spiritual force that comes around this time of year in which I can grab the coattails of that spiritual essence. And I become liberated. I can become liberated from my own inner Mitzrayim. And therefore, the statement, each person must regard themselves as if they were taken out of Mitzrayim, doesn't mean, according to this, that I have to believe or make believe or pretend that I was in Egypt. But it means I have to recognize my inner Mitzrayim. And the spiritual power of the night of Pesach is that through my connection to the Exodus narrative, I can become liberated from the Mitzrayims that enslave me, that prevent me from moving forward in life. And that is the meaning of the title I gave this lecture, that the Pesach Seder is not only a recounting of history, as important as that history is, and that history is extremely important, but it's also a paradigm for the liberation from my own inner Mitzrayims. So when you read the Haggadah, there is a double narrative that you're reading. On one hand, there is a shared common story of the historical formation of the Jewish people, how we became a nation that God chose, and this is who we are, and this is our roots, and this is our background. And the story that we lovingly share from parent to child, intergenerationally, passed down what it means to be a Jew and the meaning of Jewish peoplehood and submission to God. And that we will call the common narrative of the Haggadah, the public face of the Haggadah. And that, of course, is primary. I am certainly not denying that. But in addition to the public common narrative of Jewish peoplehood and gratitude to the Almighty, there is in the reading of everyone's Haggadah an idiosyncratic private narrative in which I identify to myself my slavery, my Mitzrayim, and I seek HaKadosh Baruch Hu's help to enable me to become liberated from my slavery. That is the inner meaning, says the Baal HaTanya, of the fourth element. I'm not going to go backwards. That fourth element, that each person must regard themselves as if they themselves were liberated from Mitzrayim, to become liberated. And you know, this is not just a metaphor. If you think about this, when I'm filled with angers, resentment, grudges, when I give up faith in myself and I feel I can't move forward, I am really chained. There's an albatross on my back. There's a boulder on my shoulders. And when I'm liberated, I'm free to become the person that I'm able to become, the person that God intended me to become. That very much is a liberation from a slavery of the greatest intensity. So now, therefore, if you look at it in that general sense, every single step of the Seder can help us achieve the spiritual liberation from the inner Mitzrayims that we have. So now let's go through it in the order that I initially presented. The first thing I pointed out was that the Seder is very much based on the notion of question and answer. You don't just give answers, you ask questions. Now, part of this, of course, is interactivity and dialogue, because normally when there's question and answer, somebody's asking the question. But, and that is important, interactivity, dialogue, sharing, transmission, that is fundamental to Jewish life in general and to the Seder in particular. But the halachic imperative of question and answer is not simply based on interactivity, because as I noted before, even if you're by yourself, and in these pandemic times, unfortunately, sometimes, or at least last year especially, hopefully less this year, sometimes people will in fact have the Seder alone, you still have to ask questions. So questions are not simply a matter of interaction. There is something intrinsically important about questions. And I would suggest that, once again, if you look at the Seder as a journey towards inner spiritual liberation, the idea of a question is a willingness to grow, a willingness to move, to go beyond your comfort level. Because when you ask a question, of course, there are two types of questions. There are questions with question marks at the end of the sentence, which are only good. There is no such thing as a bad question mark question. But then there are questions that have exclamation points, which are really just rhetorical statements. And they might be abusive. They might just be attacking. I'm not talking about those types of questions. But a question that represents a sincere desire to understand is a commitment to growth, a commitment to movement, a willingness to move beyond where I am, to embrace something new. Like the t-shirt saying, at least in the United States, I don't know about South Africa, a life is a journey, not a destination. And as long as we're moving, as long as we're growing, as long as we're seeking wisdom, then God understands that people are going to be at different stages in the road or different heights of the ladder. That's fine. The point is not where you are. The point is, what is the direction? What is the trajectory of where you're going? And one who asks honest questions is a seeker of wisdom. And that is only good. That is why in the Jewish tradition, when we have a scholar who is very, very great in Torah learning, we call him a Talmid Chacham. Now think about this if you know your Hebrew. Talmid Chacham actually means a student of the wise, or some would translate it a wise student. But either way, you're calling this great scholar who has been learning and has been a rabbi for 100 years, you're calling him a student? Why would you call an 80, 90, 100-year-old rabbi, call them a student? The answer is, the greatest compliment, the greatest praise we can pay to a spiritual leader is that he continues to grow and study and learn, because the Torah is inexhaustible, because the Torah represents God's will, and if God is infinite, God's will is infinite. And when I connect to infinity, there is no end. And therefore, the greatest scholar is also the person who continues to grow and never says, I have enough. I've done enough. I know enough. So that's element number one. Be a person who asks questions. Now, let's go to element number two. In the Haggadah story, it's not enough to talk about the good part. You got to begin with the bad part. If all you did was talk about the redemption and you didn't talk about the slavery and the suffering and the persecution, you would not have fulfilled your mitzvah. Now, why is that so? Why do I got to talk about the bad stuff? Why can't I just say all the good things that God did? So here too, we have two answers, a simple answer and a more complex answer. The simple answer is that it's the nature of human gratitude that we often do not appreciate the blessings until and unless we've experienced the bad things. So for example, some of you might have relatives or even parents who were survivors of the Holocaust, or people that came from environments of persecution, like the former Soviet Union. And when they come to a country of freedom, whether it's Israel, the United States, South Africa, in a relative sense, I don't want to get into those issues. They come to a place where they're given freedom and opportunity. They will tend to be much more grateful than people who were born in those free countries. Because people who were born into freedom don't appreciate freedom because they never experienced persecution. Same thing with physical health. Those who have never experienced sickness, and again, my bracha is that none of us should experience serious illness, sometimes don't appreciate the blessings of health. On the other hand, those who, God forbid, become ill, appreciate the health that they had, that's with sadness, and will certainly greatly appreciate the health that hopefully they will get. So it's the nature of human beings that we don't appreciate the good unless we connect to the bad. So as a result, we got to remember how bad things were in order to appreciate how good things are, or at least can be. That's a simple explanation. And again, as a simple explanation, it's a perfectly valid explanation. But there's a question on that explanation. And that is, well, wait a second here. It's God that decreed that we would be slaves. So why should I be grateful to God for taking me out of a slavery if it was the Almighty that put me into the slavery to begin with? If you remember the book of Genesis, remember the Chumash, God told Abraham that your children will be enslaved in a land that is not theirs for 400 years. Now, yes, God took us out after 210 years, 190 years earlier. So we should be grateful. We should have been there for 400 years. Well, that's like I take you, I throw you in jail, and I say, I'm coming back in a year. And instead, I come back after 6 months, and I say, be grateful to me because I've come 6 months early. Well, you might not want to cause trouble, so you'll say thank you. But in your mind, you'll be thinking, yeah, but you know, you put me in jail for 6 months. So the question is, why should I be grateful that God took me out of slavery if God is the one that put me into slavery to begin with? So consequently, we have to say that the notion of beginning with the bad is not simply remember how bad things are so that you will appreciate the freedom, but rather, this will be a little hard to grasp at first, the slavery itself is part of what we are grateful for. We are grateful for the freedom, and we are grateful for the slavery, because the slavery, not just the freedom, the slavery in Mitzrayim gave us gifts that we otherwise would never have been able to obtain on our own. So when we were free and we became slaves and then we were free, the freedom after slavery isn't simply putting you back to where you were, because if all it would be doing is putting you back to where you were, you would have a legitimate grievance on God. Why did you put me through this to begin with? But if we understand that the freedom after the slavery was a different place than what we were before the slavery, because the slavery itself gave us something precious, then we understand that the slavery itself is part of the gratitude that we are expressing. Now, how is that so? In what sense is that true? So very, very quickly, I will just give you two answers to that. Number one, the slavery in Egypt was the formation of Jewish peoplehood. That through the slavery experience, we realized that we cannot depend on other nations. We cannot depend on other people. All we have is each other in our relationship to God. That is why the Talmud tells us that the Jewish people in Egypt, even though they were not religious, even though they were idolatrous even, and even though they did not practice circumcision, except for the tribe of Levi. So on some levels, they were on a very, very low spiritual level. but they didn't change their Jewish names. They continued to speak Hebrew. They did not intermarry, and they were faithful to their wives. And they did not speak Lashon Hara. They did not speak against each other to try to get advantages with the authority. They did not, in other words, reveal things about each other that could have gotten them favors from the Egyptians. But there was group solidarity. There was unity. There was togetherness. There was a sense of a common faith. We'll call that Avas Yisrael. They were not religious, but there was love and identity. And this is something that's very, very important. You know, I remember years and years ago when I lived in Chicago, there was a non-kosher restaurant, but it was a kosher style restaurant called The Bagel. And I remember walking by that restaurant on Shabbos, and there was a sign that said, "We will give a free glass of wine for every order of cholent that you order in the restaurant." And that was a young man of around 24. And I was laughing. I was mocking at that sign because what are you talking about here? Non-kosher cholent with, you know, non-kosher food on Shabbos with wine. Maybe the wine was kosher, maybe not. Mavushel, not mavushel. Cooked wine, not cooked wine. Who knows? And some guy walks by and he remembers, "Oh yeah, my grandmother used to make cholent, so I'm going to buy that food and kind of experience the Sabbath that way." And in my cynical mind, I said, "Oh, that's gastronomic Judaism. That's worthless. That means nothing. That is an example of the superficial connection to Jewish sentimentality that has no depth and no power." But as I've grown older, and hopefully wiser, you know, who knows, I look at that little story in a very, very different way. I look at it as a person who walks by, and a person may know, obviously knows very little about Judaism, knows very little about Shabbos, simply doesn't really understand what's going on. But that person says, "I want to connect to the Jewish people in some way. I want to make a statement that this is my nation. These are my people. I don't know how to do it. I don't know what to do. But here, remember Bubby and Zadie used to have this cholent, and Zadie would make kiddush, some type of prayer on wine. So I'm going to buy this non-kosher cholent and drink this non-kosher wine." Again, the person doesn't know about kosher even. "Because I want to connect to Am Yisrael." Does that mean anything? Well, what I would say is, it's not the end product that you want, but it's the beginning. And that is what got the Jewish people out of Egypt. What got the Jewish people out of Egypt was not their frumkeit. It was not their religiosity. It was not their observance of the commandments. They didn't observe the few commandments they had. It was the sense of Jewish peoplehood and identification with Am Yisrael. "You are my people. You are my nation. I'm going to keep my Jewish name. I'm going to speak the Jewish language, which is Hebrew. I'm not going to marry outside of the faith. And I'm not going to turn against my people for temporary advantage." And although the end point of redemption is to receive the Torah, but the beginning of redemption is the identification as a Jew. In fact, if I could interject something that I think is a specific historical event in South Africa, I'm not sure how old the members of our audience are, but at least the very older members of the audience might remember the great Panovitcher Rav, one of the great, great Rabban of Lithuania who survived the Holocaust and came to Eretz Yisrael. And he often traveled around the world to raise money for his many institutions. And he would often come to South Africa because South Africa's original Jewish Ashkenazi population were Lithuanian Jews, are Lithuanian Jews. And he was kind of their rabbi. And he knew that many of his audience were not religious, they were not observant. But he told them, "If you keep your children from intermarriage, if you just ensure that Jew marry Jew, and they remain faithful members of the Jewish nation. The Panovicharov said, I promise you that the next generation or the generation after that will come back to Torah through their connection to Jewish peoplehood. And of course, anyone that knows the wonderful work of Or Sameach in South Africa and Rabbi Mofson's really legendary activities there knows how much wise and holy words of the Panovicharov have been fulfilled. Because unlike the United States, where unfortunately and tragically the intermarriage rate is very, very high, South Africa's intermarriage rate, even among people who are not so halachically observant, has been always very, very, very low. And indeed, the tshuva movement in South Africa is phenomenally successful precisely because of that identification with Jewish people. But going back to the main theme, the point I'm making is we acquired that Jewish peoplehood not through the exodus from Egypt. We acquired the Jewish peoplehood through the slavery itself. The slavery gave us that gift. But then there's another thing that slavery gave us. Slavery gave us empathy for the outsider. The Torah says more than once, you shall love the ger, love the convert, love the stranger, love the outsider, because you were outsiders in the land of Egypt. In other words, when we remember our suffering, we remember our deprivation, we don't distance ourselves from that pain, but we connect to that pain because that becomes the source of empathy and compassion for the outsider. And that's an amazing thing. In a way, it works the opposite way. On one hand, the slavery is a sense of group solidarity. On the other hand, the slavery gave us a humanitarian concern for the sufferings of all people, Jew and not Jew. That is why Jews were so involved in the civil rights movement in the United States. They were involved in anti-apartheid in South Africa. They're involved. The state of Israel will send humanitarian assistance all over the world, even to countries and to people that would be happy to destroy Israel from the face of the earth. But if you're a Jew, you care. If you're a Jew, you have rachamim. If you're a Jew, you have compassion. If you're a Jew, you're not indifferent to the sufferings of others. And the reason is because you remember what it's like to be a nobody. You remember what it's like to be abused. And that becomes the source of your empathy and your compassion. So now the point is this. When we look at the Exodus story and we're grateful to God for what he's given us, the reason we start with the bad is not simply so we'll appreciate the good, although that is true, but we start with the bad because the bad itself was part of the redemption. Now, what message does that carry forth in our own lives? In every life, there is adversity, there is challenge, there is misfortune. Things do not always work out the way we want them to work out. And this can crush us and this can fill us with despair. But the message of the Haggadah is that even in the darkness of your life, there are hidden lights that can reveal potentialities that you otherwise wouldn't have. Again, I refer you to Viktor Frankl's magnificent work, Man's Search for Meaning, in which he says, even in the darkness of the Holocaust, people, and precisely because of the darkness of the Holocaust, people were able to develop powers and potentialities that otherwise would not have been evident in normal times. And therefore, even in the darkness, there are gifts of redemption that we have to be aware of. So that is kind of the inner meaning of that second element. We now come to Rabban Gamliel, which is really three elements in one, but I'm counting it as one element. Rabban Gamliel says that you have to discuss the meaning of the Pesach, the Paschal Lamb, which we don't have today without a Beit HaMikdash, the eating of the matzah, and the eating of the maror. And let's go over each of those as they apply to spiritual liberation. And I'm going to start in reverse order. I'll explain why at the end. Let's talk about maror. Maror, the halacha obligates me to eat something bitter to remember the bitterness of Mitzrayim. How does that apply to spiritual liberation? The answer is, one of the most important things you need to do in order to be spiritually liberated is to be honest enough to acknowledge your slavery. I have to have the honesty and the courage to say that there are aspects in my life that I need to correct, whether it's anger, whether it's selfishness, whether it's laziness, whether it's egotism. Eating maror means be honest in acknowledging a slavery and don't sweep it under the rug. Because the first step in achieving spiritual liberation is the acknowledgement of some aspect of spiritual enslavement. A slave cannot be free until they first acknowledge that they are a slave. You know, I remember years and years ago, I needed to go somewhere. I was going north from Baltimore, from Washington to Baltimore. And all of a sudden, as I'm driving, again, I apologize, this may not be so familiar to non-Americans, but I started seeing the Washington Monument, the Lincoln Memorial, meaning I was going south instead of north. Somehow I turned off and I was literally going the wrong way. But I didn't want to admit to myself I was going the wrong way because I didn't know how to get on the right way. So instead, I started fantasizing, well, maybe you could see these things even from the way I should have been going, and I never noticed it before. I didn't want to admit that I was lost. So I kept on driving in the wrong direction. It's like an investment. You invest $10,000 and you'll lose it. So you keep on putting in more and more money, hoping that somehow it will change. Of course, as Albert Einstein famously remarked, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting to have a different result. But that's the point. I could not correct my mistake until I admitted that I made a mistake. Until I'm willing to admit my mistake, there's nothing I can do to correct it. That is the idea of maror. Taste the slavery. Acknowledge the slavery. Don't cover it up. I don't mean telling other people necessarily, but to yourself, be honest. But then we come to matzah. Now, there are many different takes on matzah. Matzah can represent arrogance, conceit. It's puffed up. I'm sorry, chametz rather. Chametz is puffed up. It represents arrogance and conceit. Matzah is flat. It's humility. But Maharal offers another interpretation. Maharal says that chametz represents inertia. Because if water hits the flour and you do nothing, you don't have yeast, you don't have a starter, it will become chametz automatically after 18 minutes unless you bake it and you stop the process. So chametz represents letting things happen. Matzah represents carpe diem, seizing the moment. And if maror is the cognitive awareness of my slavery, matzah is the imperative of constructive action. You know, a person might go to a psychoanalyst for years and years and years, and they intimately understand every problem, every trauma, every difficulty. And that's wonderful. But they might not do anything about it. Matzah says it's not enough to be self-aware. Self-awareness is indeed a wonderful thing. But ultimately, we need constructive and productive behavioral changes. You know, all of us in life have moments of inspiration. Maybe after Yom Kippur, after a Pesach Seder, when a child or grandchild gets married, when we look at a beautiful sunset, a beautiful garden, if a person merits to come to the land of Israel, the Kotel, Yerushalayim. These are moments of inspiration, moments of joy, moments when you want to connect to God. But the dirty little secret is, if inspiration is not concretized into virtuous action, even if it's a small action, a little extra charity, a little learning, a little extra prayer, the inspiration eventually dissipates and you're left with nothing. Inspiration has to be concretized in action to become a permanent part of our personalities. So Marar is cognitive awareness of slavery. Matzah is the imperative of doing something about it, action. And then finally, we come to eating the Korban Pesach. The Korban Pesach, of course, has many, many ideas. But the one halacha I want to bring out is there actually is a law of the Korban Pesach that you cannot eat the Korban Pesach alone, that even if you have a big appetite and a little lamb that's only a month old, and you could finish the whole thing yourself, you are not allowed to bring the Korban Pesach by yourself. You must join a group of people, either your family, or if you don't have a family, you join with a family or other people who are not a family, become a family. And here the important lesson is that in achieving spiritual liberation, we need to do it with others. We need to have friends, whether it's within the family or outside of our family, with whom we can take a journey. Shlomo HaMelech says in the book of Koheles that two are better than one, because when one falls, who will pick him up? But when you have two people and one falls, ha'echad yakim et chaveiro, one person can pick up the other. Now, this is not just talking about snow and ice, although that's true. But in life, there are times that I'm strong and there are times that I'm weak. There are times that I can prevail and there are times that I will falter. And when I have a friend, whether it's my spouse or whether it's my rabbi or whether it's my chavrusa, whether it's my community, and hopefully we'll have more than one, when I'm weak, the other can give me strength. And when they're weak, I can help give them strength. And we support each other and we sustain each other. And then we can go on and achieve a meaningful life and a good and deep relationship with God and with each other. So Maror is cognitive awareness of my slavery. Matzah is the need to concretize inspiration in action. And Pesach is the importance of community. The very last point, just give me another 2 minutes and I'll finish up, is according to this analysis, logically, we should have eaten the Maror before the matzah, because Maror tells me what my problem is and matzah tells me I have to address it. But how can I eat the matzah before the Maror? How can I start working on a problem before I know what my problem is? That's just frenetic action, like a chicken without a head. And here the answer I would suggest is, it is true that chronologically I got to know what my problem is and then work on it. But psychologically, I need to be convinced of my capacity of change before I engage in my deficits. Because if I start with my deficits, I might be filled with depression and despair and hopelessness. So eating the matzah first reminds me that I am a person that is capable of constructive change. And then and only then can I conduct my deficits. So as a result, we've identified these four elements, questions and answers, starting with the bad and proceeding to the good, the Pesach, the matzah, the maror, and all of them stem from the underlying idea that each person must regard themselves as if they were taken out of Mitzrayim. Identify your Mitzrayims, and the Seder becomes a paradigm for spiritual liberation. I want to wish you all Chag Kasher v'Sameach, a wonderful, uplifting, inspirational Pesach. I hope you'll be able to be together with your loved ones. But even if, God forbid, unfortunately, families will not be able to be fully united, know that emotionally you are all bound. And most importantly, the presence of Hashem will be with you and will give you strength, will give you courage. So once again, Chag Kasher v'Sameach, and thank you for inviting me to address you. Be well.
Just to say to Rabbi Bradovitz, a huge thank you for a brilliant presentation. The manner in which you were able to weave through the Haggadah and really bring out our own spiritual redemption was something outstanding. On a personal level, I gained a tremendous amount from your talk, as I'm sure the audience did. And in your beautiful, humble fashion, there were so many relevant points that came out. So on behalf of all of us, a huge thank you. On behalf of Reb Aaron, Reb Moshe, a huge thank you. Wonderful to be back together with you, to hear your beautiful insights in your beautiful, humble fashion. And you and your family should have a Chag Kosher v'Sameach. And thank you very much.
Thank you. Shalom. Thank you so much.